So, of course, if you put a GR. First, let me try to motivate why we want to learn it. So GR, it was kind of like invented around the end of the year on 1915. So it's over, say, 90 years old. But we still have to learn it for many reasons. There is some practice guides for it. One is just that it is really the best, the theory of gravity that works, that we know. If one wants to study cosmology, which, so we know now that for example, the universe has the span of, say, 10 billion light years. On such a large scale of space-time, the only theory of gravity that, say, that makes sense should be, say, GR for a very, say, close, say, or a very close variant of GR. So we have to understand GR in order to study cosmology. And I'm sure you have also heard about things like, say, black holes, or neutron stars, and possibly many other high density, let's say, astrophysical objects. So near those objects, the gravitational field turns out to be very strong. To have a good understanding of those gravitational field and old phenomenon that happens near the very compact astrophysical objects, we also have to understand GR. And even more practically, say, if we just try to use, say, I'm sure you all know that the GPS system. So there, since when you put the clock high above the surface of the Earth, because the gravitational field there is say, much weaker than on the ground, the clock there actually runs faster than they do on the ground. So in order to really have the GPS system to work, one has to adjust the clock on the satellite for 45 nanoseconds per day for the system to work. So even just for the engineers who did the designing work for the GPS, they have to know GR to really have things work out right. So that's actually a very useful subject to learn. And there is also some more theoretical aspects why one has to understand GR. Well, or one had better say understand GR. For one thing is that it's really a very, say, very, very amazing case in which people really just build a whole theory based on thinking and calculating without doing any direct experiment. So that's a very, how to say, it's a very amazing. It was kind of, well, so nowadays, in the research of high energy theory, it turns out that the theoretical work is really far ahead all the real experiments. So the pattern of the work, the pattern of the real research turns more and more into, say, speculation and thinking and calculating. So it may be, so by learning GR, it may really teach us some lesson of how these things may be done. Okay, so that's another motivation. And more importantly, really one of the biggest problem right now in theoretical physics is really just how to make GR to be compatible with the rest of the framework
of theoretical physics. We know that say, everything should be described by quantum mechanics, but we don't know how to quantize GR. We don't know how to quantize gravity as a field. That's really one of the most important questions, and that's one of the questions that string theory was trying to address. And also there are also say other approaches like a loop gravity that you will hear about in the coming weeks. So GR really is kind of like something that is both practical and also holds a lot of promise for future progress in theoretical physics. I mean, it's the base of that, so we have to understand it. So I said that it is really a theory that is first invented almost completely just based on thinking and calculating. So how can that be done? So let me just first give you a flavor of how the theory first how the theory first was invented. What is the path that leads to the creation of the theory? So here is a little bit of history, but it's going to be short, I promise. So in the early 20th century, at that time, there were basically two forces that were kind of relatively well understood. One is the electromagnetism, described very well by the Maxwell equations. And the other is a gravity that was long thought to be understood very well by Newton. So both these theories are kind of nice. One thing that was, okay, so there is a third ingredient that is also quite well appreciated by people at that time is the principle of relativity. So that is a big name for a very simple observation, which is that all the laws of physics should have the same form in all inertial frames. Both electromagnetism and the Newtonian mechanics obey the principle of relativity. But there is a big difference. So for the Maxwell equations, it obeys the relativity principle under the transformation called the Lorentz transformation. But for Newtonian mechanics, it is covariant under the transformation called the Galilean transformations. So the latter one is a transformation that don't mix space and time, and the former one that and the Lorentz transformation and the Lorentz transformation does mix a space and time together. So one would want to make sure that all the physics should satisfy the relativity principle, and furthermore, they should transform in the same rule. They should transform with the same rule under the change of frame. So that question is that problem, as you know very well, is well solved by the special theory of relativity, which part of which is the assertion that really the rule for the change of frames should be the Lorentz transformation that comes from the Maxwell equations. And one should try to modify the Newtonian, one should try to modify the Newtonian mechanics in such a way that it should be covariant under the Lorentz transformations. And that can be done quite simply, but it does lead to a very surprising result, like say a E has 2 equal to mc squared, in more physical terms that mass and energy should be the same concept. So that's one of the most important, I'll say byproduct of that change of view on how the spacetime should behave under change of frame. So, say after the completion of the special theory of relativity, things seems to say become quite clear what should be the next steps. So one thing is that we know there is still another force in nature which is gravity. So one would naturally want to make sure that we have a theory of gravity that really obeys the new theory of relativity, which is a special relativity. So that turns out to be a very hard problem, and you can see it in some say rough manner. In Newtonian gravity, we know that it's really simply described by an equation which looks like this. Where phi is the gravitational potential, and rho is the matter density in space. So when one really try to modify that equation to make it, say, covariant under, say, Lorentz transformation, one natural guess would be just change this del square to box, where box is E by dt squared minus this. There is a 1 over c squared, but I probably will set set c equal to 1 in many places in future, so I could be loose on that. So one natural way to try to modify it would be just you change this to that and put something here. At the left-hand side of the equation seems quite fine. It's just a scalar under the Lorentz transformation. I think you probably still remember from your class on EMM that a box is really an operator that don't transform or transform as a scalar under the Lorentz transformation. So the question is what to put here. You may think, so what appears on the right-hand side had better be also a scalar under the Lorentz transformation. One thing you can put, okay, so we can probably put, so in the case where we have just say one massive object in the whole universe, okay, in that case, it's clear what to put. You probably just put rho zero there, which is the rest mass a density of that object, which is also a scalar, so things are fine. But as soon as you try to consider a matter distribution where you have, say, several objects, and they are, say, moving around, say, each other, once you consider that, it's clear that you don't know what to put there. There is no good candidate what to put here. So that very simple-minded modification of, say, Newtonian gravity really don't work. And we will soon see that it doesn't work for good reasons. Things are really much, much more complicated. In fact, the proper way to think about gravity is the proper way to think about gravity in a way that is really consistent with the new theory of relativity is really the whole field should be generalized from a scalar field to a higher rank tensor field, actually to a G mu nu. So the mathematical object that really describes gravity is not phi, it's some field with two lower indexes there. And also what really appears on the right hand side is not should also not be a scalar density, but something that is also a tensor, which is the energy momentum tensor, which you probably have learned either from, say, fluid mechanics or from E&M. So you know that the electromagnetic wave carries some energy and momentum. And so you know what is a T mu nu is. If you don't, I will tell you what it is shortly. So so I guess what I want to say is so phi should become that and rho should become that. So that's one problem, which is how to modify the theory of gravity to make it consistent with the new theory of relativity. And another problem that is more or less more, how to say, more philosophical to me, but it's certainly a good question, is that there seems to be some intrinsic problem to the relativity principle in the sense that it appears to be quite awkward to try to distinguish the inertial frames from non-inertial frames if one, say, imagine oneself is just in a whole empty space, right? So there, even in special relativity, one has to imagine that there are two classes where there is a very special class of frames, which somehow, only for those frames, the laws of physics takes a very simple form. And when you go to all the other frames, which could be some, say, a uniformly accelerating frame, the laws of physics just, say, change their form. It seems to be there is some quite fundamental asymmetry asymmetry implied by the relativity principle. That is an observation first made by Mach. There are two questions here. One is that, the other is how to understand a relativity with that perspective, from that perspective. It turns out quite amazingly that these two approaches somehow somehow converge to the same line of thinking in the end. And the key bridge here is the equivalence principle. Okay. So I will tell you what it is now. So that's really one of the key conceptual jump in the process of the discovery of GR. So that is really another big name for another very simple observation, which is if you consider a uniformly accelerating frame, say you all have seen this very cute, say, elevator. With someone standing here. Say, on that frame is uniformly accelerating with the acceleration A. If you try to perform any physical experiment in that frame, the observation is, so as long as you are doing some experiment with pure, you are doing some a mechanical experiment, there should be no way to tell the difference whether you are in such a frame or you are in a uniform, say, gravitational field with strength A. That's a fact based on the simple observation that we all know that M inertial equals to M gravitation. So by that, I mean, so if you, so think about if you try to drop some balls, small ball, bigger ones, even bigger ones, independent their, say, chemical composition, their mass, their size, or whatever, as long as we are concentrating in a small region here, and say we assume, say, everything is uniform, then they all fall down, say, with the same speed, with the same acceleration. So that's because, so if we are in such a frame, we know just that, since the whole elevator is accelerating, so if you leave, if you stay inside the elevator, you will see they all accelerate downwards with the acceleration A. If we are in a uniform a gravitational field, so here like that, then they all feel the force and gravitational times A downward. And we know by F equal to MA, that will give them so A prime will equal A, where A prime is the real acceleration of the object in the gravitational wave, and A is the strength of the gravitational field. So here is the field, here is the real acceleration. So the point is that from either perspective you will see all the objects fall with the same acceleration. So that's a fact based on observation, and that is called sometimes as the weak version of that principle. So what this principle really say is that now we try to generalize that. So we imagine it is not only the case only for performing some mechanical experiment, but for all types of say, physical experiments, there is no way to tell the difference between a uniformly accelerating frame and a uniform gravitational field with an appropriate strength. There's no way to tell the difference by all sorts of physics experiments. So why that is important? So it's actually kind of vaguely addresses the second question of where does the asymmetry come from between the inertial frame and the non-inertial frames. And really it's just that we really try to change to an accelerating frame. One would really be missing something if one still try to think he is still in the empty space. Really there is a new field there. There is the whole gravitational field there. That's really a place where the asymmetry really slips in. Well, so that small observation aside, the key thing here really to take away is that it seems there should be a general version of the laws of physics that applies to all frame, not only just the inertial frame, but also some accelerating frame, and more generally, some arbitrary frame of coordinates. That's really what should be taken away here. And from there, actually, it gives a very good hint of what is really the right, say, mathematical object that one should use to try to describe a gravitational field. And to do that, I have probably have to say something more. So why one has to use the metric as a characterization of a general gravitational field. The proper mathematical form to describe a special relativity is the following. So what we really learn in the end, independent of how we first find it, I mean, how we first, the discovery, how Einstein first the discovery of special relativity, is that there exists a quantity in special relativity, which is you can write as delta S squared. There exists a special quantity in physics defined by C squared times delta T squared minus delta S squared minus delta Y squared that is preserved by the proper transformation rules that takes us from one inertial frame to a different one. There is a more compact way to rewrite it. I will do it, and if you don't feel happy with it, tell me. So I can also rewrite it as this. I will set C equal to 1 from now on. It's annoying to keep C. Do you have a problem with that way to write it? I mean, if you don't, that's great. So what this really says is that you can also rewrite it. Okay, I will also use X naught. So X naught equal to C T. So you can further rewrite it as e to mu nu dx mu dx mu. Where eta mu nu is a tensor with the following components. In the bases are defined by the coordinates. So what we learned is that the proper rule to transform coordinates between the inertial frames are precisely the rule that under the transformation, this tensor is invariant. In other words, in all inertial frames, that tensor takes the same form. But we also just learned from here that if we really change to some non-inertial frame, we should see the gravitational field. Therefore, the very logical step would be to say that, okay, if we really go to a general frame, then that tensor should no longer take that form. In fact, you all know how a second rank tensor like that should transform. So eta mu nu under a transformation, say, from x mu to x bar mu, where that is a new coordinate system, then eta mu nu has to go to, let's see, what is it? It's dx mu, dx rho, dx bar mu, dx sigma, dx bar mu, eta rho sigma. Okay. So if you really try to use a very general, say, nonlinear coordinate transformation, the metric tensor would have a quite the generic form. It won't be really just take that simple form, say diagonal and with all the entries, say constant. They may just take some quite generic, a second rank symmetric tensor that's, say, furthermore, say, position dependent. So that is really a crucial hint why, in the end, a gravitational field should be described by a second rank tensor field taking, say, generic values over the whole spacetime. That's how Einstein first got there. So I guess that sort of completes some of the motivation why one has to try to study some new mathematical structure beyond what is known before to the physicists before GR. I guess leaving that aside, all the foregoing stuff seems to be quite vague and may be philosophical to some of you. So now we just concentrate on the real physics. So the concrete physical questions now are the following. One is, we know that just in flat space time, suppose we know what are the equations that say describe, say, some physical theories are in a flat space time background. So does one try to generalize that? What is the proper way to describe it? Let me try to rephrase. Suppose we know the equations of some physical theory in the absence of gravity. What should be the proper equations in the presence of gravity? Or, in other words, say if we know what are the equations for physics in some inertial frame, what would be the right form of, say, the equations in some non-inertial frame? So that's one question. Some equation motion. So there are only basically one other force at that time that is kind of, say, relatively well understood, which is the electromagnetism. But we now know that there are also other forces. There are strong interaction that is important in nuclear physics. There are also the weak interaction, which is, say, unified with the electromagnetism into the electroweak theory. But say, if we just take E and M as example, then we know that in the Minkowski spacetime, the field equation is this. So one question would be, suppose now we have some gravitational field around, what would be the right way to rewrite that equation to take that into account? So that's one type of question. Another type of question would be just how, what is the right equation of motion for gravity? So we know that, so that question over there. So what is the right field equation for gravity? So I guess I just should tell you what they are now. I mean, there's no point in hiding them. So the right way to generalize that equation is really just really simple. It's this. And this one. Is where this a capital G mu nu is not a small G mu nu, but it's directly related to them, directly related to small G mu nu. As you can see, it actually depends on the second and first the derivatives of small G mu nu, as what is suggested over there. So I guess a big part of the goal of this introduction would be just to help you understand what they are. What are the meanings of, say, those equations? That's a big part of it. And to do that, we really have to do some math. And I guess the rest of today's lecture will be just say about math. So as I have motivated there, so the right mathematics to describe a gravitational field really is a curved manifold with a general metric. Now I use the word manifold, and I will explain what they are. What they are. That's what we're going to do today. Basically, I will try to explain Riemannian geometry to you. So what is a manifold? So a manifold really is just a fancy name for some object, for some objects that all of you have some intuition about. It's really just a mathematical description of some curved space. So one curved space would be just say some sphere or say some torus at the surface of some say donut, okay, that you all have seen. But the real question here is how do you make it precise? And furthermore, in general, some curved space, they cannot be embedded into some Euclidean space. And that is precisely, but so most of our intuition comes from some surfaces that can be embedded into, say, three space. Okay. Can be embedded into the three-dimensional space. So we want to have a more precise, more intrinsic way to understand what curved space are, how to describe them without the relying on some embedding. Okay. So there are actually, basically there are two things, two key properties of manifolds. One is that, so let's say we are now trying to, there is a notion of dimension for the manifold, okay? And say we can say it's a n-dimensional manifold. What does that mean? So the notion of dimension is really a local property. What we mean is just that very locally, if we look, say, locally on the manifold, we look at a small region, then there should be a continuous one-to-one map from that space, from that very small region to a flat space Rn. Okay? So locally it is Rn. So the point is really try to understand some curved manifold using all the tools that we have for some, say, flat space. Okay. So locally it is Rn. But we know there should be some curved property of, say, the manifold that can't be captured by some local description. And that is described by the global property. By that we mean that if we really try to, so the way to fully specify the smooth structure of a manifold is that we choose a lot of, say, local patches, and we use all of them. So we choose the local patches in such a way that they can cover, say, precisely the whole manifold. And the global property of the manifold is captured by how these patches are glued together. So to be more precise, so let's try to give an example. So take a two sphere, like an egg. So on a small region here, we can find a map to R2, okay? Map it to R2 somewhere. So we can find a lot of small patches that are diffeomorphic to R2. So how do we know in the end, say, oh, by the way, so a set of patches that cover the whole manifold, so completely, is called an atlas. That's just a name. So if I give you an atlas, how do you know it is a two sphere rather than something else? So it's actually quite simple. It's just to take, so the simplest atlas in this case consists of two patches.
Right.
I mean, just take, say, for example, you take a patch. There is a north patch. Okay. You think about the patches cover, say, everything above the latitude. Okay. Including at the North Pole, there is a north patch. You can also take a south patch, which, say, covers, say, everything below the equator. So those two patches cover the two spheres, say, completely, and they overlap in some region. Say one patch is mapped to some region on R2. The other patch is mapped to some other region in R2. And near the boundary here, near the boundary here, overlap each other on the two sphere, and one should specify, and one can specify the global structure just by specifying the information of how one should identify points on this band with points on that band. All these things are very intuitive. I mean, one does not really have to write down any equations. You can just give it a thought, and you realize that that really suffice to specify the global differential structure of the whole manifold. That's just for sphere, but in general it is the case. Basically, you just take an atlas. That is enough. There are more things that So there are many ways for picking the atlas. So in this case, you can choose try to separate the whole sphere to the north by the north say, hemisphere and south hemisphere. You can also try to separate by the east and west. They give the same thing, and you can work with say, any one of them, so it's just fine. And there is some say, compatibility say, condition between a different choice of atlas of atlases. We are not going to go into that. It's just a trivial point. So that's what a manifold is. And on a manifold, it's time. Okay, I will just. Now on a manifold, we want to talk about. Eventually, we want to understand how say, does one say, measure the distance on a curved manifold, and we want to talk about how to measure say, the curvature of the manifold. Both of these, we want to do it in some intrinsic way, so that we don't have to talk about say embedding. Right? So let's go. We want to understand curvature of a curved manifold. We want to understand the distance or length of some line or some trajectory. To go there, we have to really go slowly and try to introduce some concepts. So one thing is, once we have a curved manifold, we want to understand what is a tangent space. And that is also something you have a lot of intuition about. If we just take a curve on the plane, the tangent space is just like that, right? So it's like a line that goes tangent to the curve at some particular point. Tangent space at some point. That is again one intuition that you have given some curve or surface or manifold that can be embedded into some say flat space. So you know how to talk about them. So the question now is how to generalize the concept of a tangent space to a manifold that you don't know how to embed it. How do you give an intrinsic way to understand it? And it's actually still a very simple idea. First of all, what properties a tangent space should have? So that's a curve. If I have a surface, still say a sphere, and now I take a point here, and then I have a tangent space to that point. What property does the tangent space have? First is that it has to be a vector space. I guess you all know what a vector space is, right? Okay. So if say the manifold is n-dimensional, then the vector space has to be a dimension n. That's just what it had better be, what it had better be. So how do we really try to construct this vector space, given the fact that we don't know an embedding? So the idea is really just try to describe it by their action on functions on the manifold. Now we have a manifold. Now we can think about all the functions on the manifold. We have the manifold, we have some local patches, which are diffeomorphic to Rn. And now we can talk about what are the functions. So by the diffeomorphism of the local patch to Rn, we can also push the function also to Rn. Do you understand that language? I mean, okay, so good. So say if I have a patch which I call U, and when I say it is a diffeomorphic to some patch In Rn, what I mean is that there is a map phi, let's say phi sub u, which maps u to Rn. That is one-to-one, that is a continuous. So let's say there are, say, also smooths. So now, say, suppose I call the whole manifold as M. Suppose now I have a function on M, which is by definition a map from M to R. Then naturally, I can have a new function, which is F, let's see, phi inverse, that maps Rn to R. Well, let me be more precise. So the point is that the phi is a map from a local patch to Rn, but although it is one to one, but it's not onto. So some points on Rn is probably not the image of the points in the small patch. Therefore, so when I really try to invert the map phi u here. So the domain of that, the domain of definition for the map phi of u lives only in the image of phi of u. That is a subset of Rn. So the point is that just that there is a very well-defined way. So by the very definition of the manifold, there is a very well-defined way to relate points in a very well-defined one-to-one manner to points on Rn. So therefore, when you have a function on the whole manifold, you can very naturally associate the function to Rn. But just like, say, think about, you have two spaces and you can try to identify the points of one space to another. Therefore, when you have a function on the first space, well, you can prove to that function to the second space. Okay. So it's just that, there's not anything more than that. It's a very simple idea. Everything I'm going to tell you today are going to be very simple. So that being said, so now how do we try to understand what is a tangent space to a point on a curved manifold? So the point is, now we just consider functions on the curved manifold. And we can consider a local patch. We can consider a local coordinates of near that point P, where we want to take the tangent space. So there will be some local coordinates, which I will call, say, xi, I goes from 1 to n. They label the points of the manifold near that point. Okay. So we can consider the following operators, which are d by dxi. They are all evaluated at p, where p is the point of the manifold. Okay. So these things, think about them as operators acting on functions on the manifold. Think of those as operators acting on the functions of manifold. They clearly satisfy the properties of a vector space. Well, here I actually should write something more. I would just write AI, sum over I. I goes from 1 to n. AIs are some constant. AIs are some real numbers. There are n of them. So I look at the, so these things, they can act on functions in some very trivial way. So you all know how to take C derivatives, right? Okay. So that is, think about this object as an operator acting on functions locally defined near that point on the manifold. You can add them, you can multiply them by real numbers, and they satisfy all the properties that the vectors in a vector space should satisfy. There are those associativity under six scalar semi-modification. There are, well, is it called? Well, there are, well, okay. You know what I mean. A plus B, V is A, V plus B, V, things like that. Okay, so you can check. Those objects satisfy all the properties of a vector space. Furthermore, it is clear that they have dimension n. So that is really a genuine n-dimensional vector space intrinsically specified near that point, precisely at that point. So the right way to think about a tangent space is really just a vector space formed by those objects. That is an n-dimensional, vector space. That is what a tangent space is. And it's really very, very intuitive. Think about, say, if you have a surface, and if we take, say, that point, and you want to talk about a vector that, say, goes in that direction or goes in that direction, what is the intrinsic way to tell the difference? You just try to measure the two vectors by some functions and see how the function changes along those, say, two directions. So that's really, say, what's going on there. It's just, if you take all the functions that you can define in that, say, local region and try to see how they change, in the end, you will just be able to determine what those vectors are. So there is a nice, say, correspondence here. That is what a tangent space is. Now, for that purpose, we'd better also tell you what is a cotangent space. That is defined more abstractly. Since you know what a vector space is, you know how to define a dual vector space, right? A dual vector space is really just the linear functions on the vector space. So this thing, I'll give it a name, call it TP, where P is the point. T, in general, specifies some tangent bundle at that point, which is the tangent space. But so here I will call it TP star. So there I have a vector space TP, and I just take the dual vector space TP star, that is the cotangent space. Well, okay, that's what I can do for this. Okay, so there is a nice way. Good. So here, one more thing I can say here. So for any choice of a local coordinates is associated to a natural choice of basis for the tangent space here. And that is just say d by di, where I goes from 1 to n. That is a choice of basis. So here, well, when you pick a choice of basis for a vector space, there is a natural choice of basis in the dual vector space. Although in general there is no say natural map from those two spaces. So here is just that we just try to so here is just some more notation. If I have a basis xi here, then I use the notation di to denote the basis in the cotangent space corresponding to this choice of coordinates. So that's defined by that. So Because so one thing in the end we would like to know is, I mean, say we know, okay, so now the next thing would be we want to know what is a tensor field on a manifold. We want to know that because we know that, say, the field A mu in the field the gauge potential in the A mu in the gauge potential for the gauge potential for the electromagnetism is a one form or a particular kind of tensor field in Minkowski space, and also at the field strength. F mu is a two form or another particular type of tensor field in Minkowski space. And now when we try to generalize things from flat spacetime to a curved spacetime, we also want to know what would be the corresponding, say, objects that should describe the field strength and field potential. And that is what a tensor field is. And a tensor field, so for that matter, we first have to know what is a tensor. So a tensor field on the manifold is really just a tensor that is a tensor valued function on the whole manifold is a tensor in every, say, tangent space. And then you just put a tensor, say, everywhere in some, say, smooth manner, then you get a smooth tensor field. So first we have to understand what is a tensor. So a tensor is a linear map, a tensor for a vector field. A tensor in, sorry, a vector space on a vector space is a map from the two vector space from certain tensor product of the two vector space and the vector space itself to R. That is a linear map. That is, say, furthermore linear in all the arguments. Do you understand what I mean? Do you understand what I mean by the codependent space or by the two vector space? Okay, I probably have lost you. You know what a vector space is. Okay, a two vector space let me see, what is the right way to think about it? So first of all, there are some very nice properties of the two vector space. It's as a linear space, if the vector space itself, so there's nothing fancy about a vector space. You can think about them just as Rn or something. You can just think about them as some flat part, Rn. And a two vector space by itself, a two vector space due to the vector space itself is still just a vector space by itself with the same dimension. So it is still, you can still think about it as Rn, okay? If that really makes you happy. But furthermore, so they carry some structure associated with the original vector space. And that structure is specified by the fact that the two vectors, any given vector in the two vector space is a linear function on the vector space, taking value in a real number. By that, what I mean is that suppose you have a vector space V, it's a set of vectors, and it's really just have the same structure as Rn. By that, I mean for all the vectors, you can choose a basis and to specify. Can you see this? Or okay. By that, What I mean is that you can choose a basis in such a way that any given vector in the vector space can be expanded in terms of basis, and you can specify them by, say, precisely n real coefficients. Therefore, there is a one-to-one correspondence between the vectors in the vector space to Rn. That is what a vector space is and why it is isomorphic to Rn. And now, what is a dual vector space? A dual vector space is a set, let me call it F. And any given element in the dual vector space is a function on V. So for any F, they map V to R. Okay. Furthermore, it is a linear function in the sense that F, for example, acting on a vector AV is equal to A times FV, F acting on V plus V1 plus V2 equal to F V1, V1 plus F V2. There are those very natural properties that that one has to have in mind. I mean, that had better to be satisfied if we can call it a linear function. They are all very intuitive. So what these things are, so they are linear functions on the vector space. So why they form an n-dimensional, say, vector space? So think about the following set of so one can really pick a basis for the dual vector space. I just told you, so that is really what is going on here. So here, say, for V, we have a basis, which I call VI. So any vector in V can be expanded as a sum. Now I can think about the following set of, say, linear functions on V. Now I consider Fi in V star. They have the property that Fi acting on Vj equal to delta ij. So in other words, Fi maps. So now I specified this particular function by its action on the basis of the vector space, by the fact that these functions are linear, and by the fact that all the vectors in the vector space can be expanded in terms of basis, that uniquely specify how does a function act on a general vector. Right? I can write it out. So for a general vector, which is can be expanded in terms of aj, vj, sum over j, is just given by ai, using the linearity property of the map. That defines n Fi's. So I here runs from one to, we take I from one to n, that say defines n particular linear functions on V, that is particular n elements in V star in the dual vector space. And now I claim that really forms a basis for the dual vector space. In other words, all the linear functions on V should be able to be expanded in terms of the Fi's. And that is very simple to see, because if you just take an arbitrary F, let's say acting on V, let's say V is again sum over j, aj, vj. That is going to be, given that it is a linear map, it has to be possible to expand. That has to be a linear function. So let me write one more step. So that is sum over j, aj, f, vj. Okay. F, vj are just some numbers. Some numbers. Okay. So that tells us how to expand f in terms of the basis. The coefficient is precisely f at on vj. Are you following? Or okay. So here I just showed you that the two vector space, the space of linear functions on a vector space, is a vector space by itself with the same dimension. And furthermore, given any basis of the original vector space, there is a canonical choice of basis for the two vector space. And that is what I write here. So when you have a local coordinates around a point, then there is a natural basis for the tangent space, and that induces a natural basis for the cotangent space. And I also introduced the symbol here, where d by dxj would be the natural basis for the tangent space, dxj would be the natural basis for the cotangent space. So once we have that, we can talk about what a tensor is now. So a tensor is a linear map. So when you have a tensor, the first thing that you can ask is what are the indexes of the tensor that carries. So that is the old way that we tend to think about what the tensor is. So furthermore, the index can be downstairs or and can be upstairs. Okay. So what is being written here is just really tells you how many indexes are there and how many of them are down, how many of them are up, how many of them are down. So here, the structure being specified here precisely, so there are two types, so there are two integers here. Let's say call this m, that is n. So m is precisely how many indexes there are down, and n tells you how many indexes there are up. And how those two things are related, how or why are these two things are related, I'm going to show you right now. Okay. So first, let me tell you what exactly do I mean when I say x is linear. So by that I mean, if I take x, it is a function on this whole big vector space. If I fix, so there are altogether m plus n arguments for the function. If I fix all the other, if I fix all the arguments except one, then I demand that the function as a function of that particular argument should be a linear function. That's what I mean, that x is a linear function from this whole space to R, is that it has to be linear separately for each argument. Now, let's see, how does the lower and upper indexes come from? It comes very simply. So we've already had some basis for the V star and V, say, if we choose some basis, okay? Then we can just ask, what is the value of x on the basis? So here I can just choose, say here, dxi, 1, dxi, m, and here I, okay, so I will use a simplified notation, di is the same as d by dxi from now. So I just evaluate this x on those particular vectors. And that gives me a number. And I will just write that number as I1, IM, J1. Okay. So in other words, those things that you see that carry some, say, index, they are just the value of the function on some particular vectors in the whole space. They are just some components of the function. Well, why do I want to use this fancy thing that confuses, say, say everyone? Because I'd better do, I mean, that is really the only way to do it. I can't think about another way that is essentially simpler, that say also works on a general curved manifold that provides an intrinsic way to define what a tensor is. I mean, there's just no other way to do it. You have to bear with it. I mean, so everything has something that when you learn a new subject, there is some curve that one has to climb. Since we start late, we probably will just go over a little bit. I have quite a few things to say. But I promise you I will not keep you here too long. So that is what a tensor is, a tensor on a vector space. What is a tensor field? As I said, it's just you can specify a tensor on every tangent space on the manifold. You can specify a tensor in the tangent space on every point of the manifold. And the data that you need to specify a particular tensor at one particular given point is precisely all the values of the components here. Once you know what is the value of the linear function on all the possible ways for you to put in a basis, by the linearity condition, again, you know what is the whole linear function. So the data that you need to know the value of the tensor, or to know what is the tensor is at each point, is precisely those numbers. And you can do a simple counting. If the whole manifold is n-dimensional, then there are altogether n to the power of n plus n components that one need to specify the value of a tensor at each point. So now once you can specify a tensor at a given point, now you just do it for every point, you get a tensor field by definition. A mu and f mu, a mu and f mu nu are precisely some special case for this kind of object. One other thing is that from here you see under a coordinate transformation, the components of the tensor transform very nicely. They transform in a linear, a homogeneous manner. Right, so here's one thing that I should have told you, which I forgot, which only appears right now to be, only appears now to be important. So this definition of the vector space automatically tells you how should one transform the vector when one change the local coordinates? Because you know how, I mean, how derivatives are related to how derivatives are related to each other. Say if I for one particular say vector v that is in this form, right? From now on, I've also used the shorthand annotation that when I write two things, one carries an upper index, the other carries a lower index. So this carries a lower index because I said I can write it like that by convention. When I write two things, one carry a upper index, the other carry a lower index, and for the index have the same letter, I always mean that I have to sum over them. So AI DI by definition is sum over AI DI. I goes from one to n. That's a convention. That's a convention. Just to make things simpler. There's okay, that's just a convention. So what I want to say is that suppose I have a vector that is specified by the components AI in one basis, specified by the coordinates, specified by the coordinate XI. Now, if I change to a new coordinate, which I call X bar I, how do I know? And there is an associated new basis for the same attendant space. What is the rule to find out the right components in the new basis? That is something that is directly, I mean, that is something implied by the definition here. So the new coefficients, which I will call BI, okay, which I will call BI, should be specified in such a way that these two objects act in the same way on an arbitrary function defined near the point. So that is enough to tell us how to find out the transform between the coefficients. So if AI DI acting on F is the same as BI B bar I acting on F. For arbitrary F, that means this. So let me write on this slide. So this thing is AI DF DXI is equal to AI DF dx bar j dx bar j dx I. Here I also sum over j using the summation convention. And on this side, I have bj, bj bar, bj, dx, dx bar j. So for if that holds so note these two things, okay. For if they should equal to each other for an arbitrary f, then that implies the coefficients of the expansion on the two sides should be the same. So that tells us how, once we know what are the components in one basis, so the rule to figure out the components in another basis is derived here, to be given by this. So from here, you'll see that this is really just a n by n matrix. Okay, it's just n by n matrix, and all these things are evaluated at the particular point. So that's a linear transformation on a n-dimensional vector space. If you think about this A, B is being the coordinates on some vector space. That's say precisely what we are here. I mean, they should be, since we just all we does here is just that we change the basis of the tangent space at a point from one associated with the coordinate x I to the one associated with the coordinates x bar I, and that is the rule for the transformation of the coefficients. What I want to say here is just that it's a very simple you can convince yourself very easily that if we define a tensor on a vector space in that way, you can derive for yourself that the way for the components of X, the way for a component of tensor transforms is very simple. I don't want to write the whole thing down. I just give you an example. Let's choose a 2,1 tensor. Okay. Then that's a component. So in a new coordinate system, let's say the component is X bar, it's related to the components in the original L M N in a very similar way, X R I L X bar J M X bar K. Where are the ones? So here, note that L, M, N are being summed over, since they appear once upstairs and once lower stairs. Once downstairs, M here and here, and here and here. So they are summed over. The indexes that are free, not being summed over on the right hand side, are still I, J, K. And okay, they also appear free on the left. So on the right hand side, there is an object carrying two upper index I, J, and one lower index K. On the right hand side, there's another object that carries two upper index ij, one lower index k. The other indexes on the right hand side are being summed over, they don't count. You can rename them, they are being summed over. So the point I'm trying to make here is that tensors defined that way transform very naturally, as they should be under coordinate transformation. The last thing I want to say today is, now we are fully equipped to understand how to think about a distance, how to think about, say, distance on a curved manifold. We can now try to say, if I take a curve on a manifold, if I specify a line on a manifold, how do you say measure? How do you measure its length? Do I have a free blackboard? Oh, this is a bad idea. I'll keep this. So how do we measure a distance or the length of some curve? First of all, on a curved manifold, if I just give you two points, there is no symmetric definition of a distance, okay? Because you can choose a line, say, connecting the two points. You can talk about the length of the curve, but So the length will depend on, say, which curve you choose. So one sensible way to really try to understand what a distance is maybe, so would be just you say consider all the possible curves and then choose what is the curve with the shortest length and call that say the distance. Okay. So what we have to understand first is how to define a length to a generic curve on a manifold. And the object that does that is called the metric. That's again just a name. What it is a symmetric rank 2 tensor, which I write as GAB. That is, by the way, related to the small G mu nil that we see at the very beginning of the lecture, that in the end would turn out to specify a generic gravitational field. So GAB is really just a second rank symmetric tensor. It maps V cross V to R. What that means is that if you just take two vectors, U and V, that gives you a real number. It furthermore has to be symmetric, which means if you change U and V, they give the same number. That is a metric on a vector space. And now we want to talk about length on a general, say, manifold. Again, we just have to choose a metric on every single point. That gives us, again, a tensor field on the manifold. So a metric on a manifold is specified by a second rank symmetric tensor field on the manifold. It normally has to satisfy some more conditions because, say, we want, say, the distance to be positive, say, always to be positive. So in other words, we want some positivity condition. Which is if I make the two entries to be the same vector, that has better be positive definite and only vanishes if U is zero. Okay. That is the positivity condition one need. From here, so that's what a positive, a definite metric on a vector space is. And now if we specify such a metric on every single point of the manifold in some smooth way that gives us a manifold with a positive, a definite metric everywhere, that is called a Riemannian manifold. And if you hear people talk about Riemannian geometry, it is a subject of studying the properties of the manifold with such a further structure on them. So one more thing that you probably know is that if, say, locally on every single point where you have such a positive definite symmetric second rank tensor, you can always choose a basis such that the G looks really simple. It looks like this, +1, +1 everywhere and zero like that. You can always do that by properly choosing the basis. Um, Right, and sorry. Now let's say what is, how do you measure the length of a curve? Suppose I have a curve on a curved manifold that is specified by some function xi of t, where t is a real number. So that's the way we specify a curve. A curve is a map from R1 to the manifold. And by using the local coordinates, you can push that map from the R1 to Rn. And that is what it is. So the length ds or s from two points A to B is given by this. That is the length. And you can see that it is positive definite for one thing, because what is given here is g t t where t is dxi dt di. So that is positive. So that is a positive definite quantity. It tells us what is the length between the two points are, between the two points is. And it is a homework for you. It's not in the official homework, but it's simpler than the official homework, and would to help you to understand this better. So you can go back and check that this particular form of the length of the curve is independent of the choice of coordinates. In other words, you can change the coordinates from xi to yi. Then both this quantity and gij has to transform. So gij is a tensor field. It will transform in a rule similar to that. Okay. So you will see that the transformation of this quantity and the transformation of the product of those two quantities precisely cancel. Well, precisely balance each other so that the final result is independent of the choice of coordinate. So that is, so that gives you an intrinsic way to define what is the length of curve is. I think we are 20 minutes over time, and I really apologize. So that is over today. And I finished half of what I want to say. So given that I have two lectures for GR, it seems like I have to use four lectures, but we'll see what happens. And also, I just don't know if I have lost the many of you because I don't hear anybody say asking questions. Well, okay. So I will leave you my email. If you have any suggestions or comments to me, you can write to me.